Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Oh, look, another Fed meeting come and gone. What do you suppose they said? And what do you suppose it means? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, June 19. Good as always to have you along with us, everybody. We are going to stipulate here. In fact, we are going to lean into it. That trying to interpret the Federal Reserve, plain spoken as Jay Powell tries to be, is not unlike the Kremlinology of years gone by. Trying to figure out who was in charge by looking at who was standing next to whom at the May Day parades, except with the Fed, it's parsing every syllable that comes out of Jay Powell's mouth. So, today, an experiment of sorts with the ultimate goal of figuring out how well the Fed is saying what it wants to say and how well we are interpreting it. We got some people on the phone today, just a couple of minutes before the Fed's announcement wrapping up its two-day meeting on interest rates. This was 2 o'clock East Coast time, and we asked what they thought was going to happen.
I'm Sydney Ludvigson. I'm a professor of economics at New York University. It's 1:41 p.m. on June 19th, 2019. Well, I would say that we're sort of expecting them to hold the line on rates for now, but perhaps switch their language to a more ready-to-act description of how they will perceive future risks and, just expressing a willingness to act should, you know, the data turn worse than it's been.
My name is Ming Jia. I'm a trading manager at Betterment, and it is 1:57 p.m. on June 19th, 2019. I'm leaning towards, I think it's going to be more of a cautious to hawkish kind of tone that they're going to take. I think they're going to leave rates uncut, but signal to a cut in December, or they might mention in the near future. I really can't see them cutting in July unless it's an emergency.
Spoiler alert, they were both basically right. No rate cut now, but, well, here's Chair Powell.
Overall, our policy discussions focused on the appropriate response to the uncertain environment. The projections of appropriate policy show that many participants believe that some cut in the federal funds rate will be appropriate in the scenario that they see as most likely.
No more patience for the Fed, if you think back to the last couple of minutes. We got back on the phone with our test subjects after Chair Powell's press conference to see how they were feeling about their predictions. First up, Sydney Ludvigson at NYU Stern.
I didn't see much to contradict what I expected. You know, the message is we're not quite saying that we're in patient mode anymore, but we are not cutting anything today, but we're actively monitoring for more sustained evidence of the kind of uncertainties and concerns that the chairman was talking about.
So she was right. Here's Ming Jia at Betterment.
I listened back to it because, you know, of my own ego, and I was like, was I right? I definitely feel like the markets were expecting something a lot more dovish than what came out.
I think that's probably true. Dovish there, by the way, means not at all worried, not all that really worried about inflation. They're worried a little bit, thus leaning more toward cutting rates than raising rates. I know there are a lot of people out there to whom this obsession with what the Fed says sounds, you know, obsessive. But A, it is the entire American economy and probably the global economy as well that we're talking about here. But also, B, the Fed knows we're watching. Here's Ming Jia one more time from Betterment.
We analyze Fed speeches like an eighth grader analyzes like text messages, you know, like every single word matters. Every single word counts. After 2008, they realized like, oh, the markets are watching. And especially with the rapid dissemination of their like press releases and how quickly markets respond to things like that, I think they have only become more cautious.
Cautious and aware. On that note, by the way, about the whole timeline of this thing, if you want a historical look at what the Fed has done with interest rates over time, we have that at marketplace.org. The Fed is not, of course, the only actor on the economic policy stage. It's been about a year and a half since the GOP's tax overhaul took effect, a change that was promoted in large part as benefiting workers. It can, of course, take a while to understand the real impact of the kinds of big changes the Tax Cut and Jobs Act wrought, but we are starting to get some clues. Marketplace's Justin Ho has more on that one.
The new tax law chopped the corporate tax rate from 35% to 21%. Big employers, including Wells Fargo, Home Depot, and Walmart, announced they'd use some of those savings to give out bonuses. Seth Carpenter is the chief U.S. economist at UBS.
One of the benefits for firms in giving up bonuses is that it allows you to make a decision one year and then not carry forward with it.
In fact, they're not carrying forward. The Labor Department says bonuses are down this year by 24%. Supporters of the Republican overhaul promised that the corporate tax cuts would lead to a surge in corporate investments, maybe new factories or a new robot.
But that's not what we've seen. We've seen a lot of it used for either short-term financing, restructuring, stock buybacks.
That's Adam Rosenzweig at Washington University in St. Louis. In 2018, companies spent $200 billion more on stock buybacks than on research and development. Meanwhile, the Treasury Department said corporate tax revenue fell by 9% so far this year. Thing is, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office had predicted that revenue would increase, and Republicans promised that the tax cuts would pay for themselves.
The idea that tax cuts pay for themselves, I think, is something of a myth.
That's Leander Letterman, a professor of tax law at Indiana University. There are a number of reasons why corporate tax revenues could be falling, but bottom line, says Seth Carpenter at UBS,
it should surprise absolutely no one that cutting taxes ends up cutting government revenues.
And he says the ongoing trade war with China could hit tax revenues even harder. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, equities were fine. Not for the first time, though, I say this. Keep an eye on the bond market, please. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. YouTube is under a whole bunch of scrutiny over how it figures out what to show people, kids in particular, and some not-so-kid-friendly content. The Wall Street Journal reports the company is looking into disabling its autoplay feature and moving all of its children's content to its less popular platform, YouTube Kids. In a strictly business sense here, it's risky. Children's videos are among the most popular and profitable content on that platform. Marketplace's Renata Sago has the story.
If you go to YouTube and type kids video, this is one of the clips that comes up.
Humpty Dumpty sat on the wall. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall.
It's a cartoon of a little boy dancing in an egg costume. So far, so good. But let YouTube keep autoplaying as it does by default, and its algorithm might lead you to this. It sounds innocuous, but it's a 10-minute clip of a half-naked woman carrying a baby doll. Jill Murphy, who runs the parents' advocacy nonprofit Common Sense Media, says, welcome to YouTube's algorithmic rabbit hole.
It's just this wild west for parents.
A survey from the Pew Research Center last year found that more than a third of parents let their children 11 and under watch YouTube regularly. Murphy says that's why the platform needs to bring in humans to curate content, like traditional TV.
It's vetted, it's thorough, it's scripted. There's a real checks and balances system.
YouTube says 400 hours of content are added to its platform every minute. Safia Noble at the University of Southern California says with all that material, YouTube may need to change its model for children's content completely.
They're going to have to get much more specific and specialized and channeled with that content. More consumer control, the better.
But any changes could hurt YouTube's revenue. According to the research firm eMarketer, the platform sold more than $3 billion worth of ads last year. I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
When was the last time you ordered something, not online, but from a catalog? Think Amazon, but in a magazine, right? They used to be all that in mail order, now less so. But there are some legacy catalog companies out there that are adapting to the digital age. Land's End made its name in the old-time catalog business, casual clothing, luggage, home decor. Now it has seen the digital light. Jerome Griffith took the CEO job at Land's End about 2.5 years ago, trying to bring the company back after years of declining sales and not always great ownership by Sears. Mr. Griffith, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Would you be offended if I said that probably most people listening to this and hearing Land's End are going to think of that old catalog company from like the 80s and 90s?
Some people might. That would be true.
So my guess would be a lot, but let's go let's go with my premise here. The question really is, how do you take an old catalog-y company, which you know, and you've been at Land's End not since the very beginning, but for a couple of years now. How do you take that company and turn it into an e-commerce company, which kind of have to be in retail today?
What's interesting is the reason I came to the company was I saw it as an e-commerce company because 87% at the time, 87% of everything they sold was done through a click, but it was not being run like an e-commerce company. It was being run like a catalog company from the 80s with systems from the 80s. And we've really turned the company into, I would say, a digital innovator. I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, the people that you're hiring, the money that you're investing, and also how do you treat your customer? Because everything is very customer-centric nowadays.
Okay, so if you're doing the shift toward being more sensitive to e-commerce and your online customers, why then are you investing in brick-and-mortar stores? You know, I mean, Land's End wants to have this physical presence as well.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, during the time when we had ownership by Sears, we had a several hundred million dollar business from brick and mortar. And as Sears has closed and changed strategies, that's basically gone away. Additionally, customers that shop digitally native companies have said, you know, we would like a place to interact with the brand, not just online. I think we have a leg up on our competition in some ways because we know where our customer lives and we know what they buy.
Those consumers, who are they? Are you getting the millennials that every company now seems to believe that it needs? Is it mostly grandmas and grandpas? Who are you selling to?
You know, our average consumer is in their early 50s. They're relatively affluent. They live in the suburbs. They use their smartphone. They value comfort. They are more digitally savvy than what you would actually expect. And at what we've seen over the course of the last couple of years is our average consumer's age is creeping down, meaning getting a little bit younger, but it's not a radical shift. I think one of the things that people get confused about is, you know, when you need to change a company, you want to, people go in and make radical shifts. Well, you only do that if a company is really failing. Customer retention, our numbers are extremely high in the industry.
A word here about Amazon, if we could. You have made the decision that you're actually going to be on Amazon and sell there, and I want to know why. Are you not worried about Amazon, or are you just going where your customers are going to be?
More than 50% of all searches on clothing are on Amazon. So if you're not on Amazon, you're not relevant.
Full stop.
Full stop.
Do you fear the Amazon juggernaut at all, or are you in bed with a giant and you're making the best of it?
I have somewhere in between the two, I think. You know, Amazon's been a good partner for us. What they've brought to the party is a lot of new customers. You know, our average consumer is mostly female, well over 70%. But on Amazon, we find two things. They're a little bit younger, and they're a little bit more male. And what we also find is that over half of our sales on Amazon are through customers that have never dealt with the brand Land's End before. And another 27% are customers that did shop at Land's End once but haven't shopped there in over a year, up to 5 years. So there's very little existing customer crossover. And as long as that stays true and as long as we're still selling our best sellers on Amazon, same as we do on our own website, we'll stick with them. So they've been a good partner so far.
You've been doing this 40 plus or minus years, right? In retail and apparel, you were at
sad but true.
you were at Tumi, the luggage company. Before this, you were set to retire. Why'd you take this job?
Few reasons. One, it was an e-commerce company, and I saw the challenge because they didn't run it like it was. Second was because the brand was not tarnished from its years at Sears, which ended up being a relationship which wasn't the best for the brand. But the consumer still looked at Land's End as, you know, a nice, safe, understandable heritage brand. Plus, I didn't really feel like sitting around the house being retired.
Yeah, I hear you on that one. Jerome Griffith of Land's End. Mr. Griffith, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Kai, good talking to you. Thank you very much.
There was more, as there always is, to that conversation than we had time for here, like how Jerome Griffith knows where to put all those physical stores the company is opening Here's a hint. That old saw, location, 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 it actually matters. You can hear the whole thing on our Corner Office podcast. Coming up.
That's when I said I became an official geezer.
That seems harsh, but okay. First, though, let's do the numbers. Markets spend most of the day biding their time in advance of news from the Fed. The Dow Industrials finished the session up a 0.1%, 38 points, 26,504. The S&P 500 gained almost 0.3%, that is 8 points, 29.26. The NASDAQ up 0.4%, 33 points, 79.87 there. Fed did a number on bank stocks today. I'll tell you what, Comerica ended the day down 1.7%, SunTrust down 0.5%, Bank of America down 1% today. CBS and Viacom might be getting the band back together. The two split up more than 13 years ago, but according to today's Wall Street Journal, they are talking about a reunion. CBS up 1% on the news, Viacom gained 2.2%. Bonds, as promised, prices were up. Yield on the 10-year T-note slipped to 2.02%. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace turned 30 this year, and to celebrate, we are going back to the 1980s. Check out our new thank you gifts that you can choose from when you become a Marketplace investor. Your donation, big or small, will help us keep bringing you news and information you trust for years to come. So please donate today at marketplace.org. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today, in ticker symbols that could not be more perfect, WORK. Slack, the company behind the popular intra-office instant messaging service, is expected to go public tomorrow. And I see perfect because somehow Slack has convinced companies that letting people ping messages at each other, not just about work, but also about pets and parenting and happy hours and what have you, somehow that's all good for business. Here's Marketplace's Jack Stewart.
You probably know Slack as this sound as messages come in. And the place where you get your boss's latest demands, random messages from your coworkers, and where you can reply to them all with a GIF of a head exploding. We asked for your impressions of Slack. Jonathan Sender in New York got in touch. He runs marketing at a small supermarket chain. He's a fan.
We're able to use the platform pretty much all day and Slack over all sorts of different files. It's a pretty amazing tool.
That's what Slack wants to hear, that it's a replacement for the dreaded email. But beyond that, what is Slack? In the S1 listing prospectus, the company says, quote, "We and the rest of the world still have a hard time explaining Slack. It's been called an operating system for teams, a hub for collaboration, a connective tissue across the organization, and much else."
I do like this notion of the connective tissue within a workplace or a workforce. Practically speaking, that's a lot of what it does.
April Rinney advises startups and others on the future of work. She says the ability for Slack users to customize, like adding apps, means that it can change to suit teams' needs.
We can pinpoint what it is perhaps today, but that's different than what it was yesterday, and that's certainly going to be different than what it's going to be from Thursday onwards. I look at Slack in a way, it's almost as though it's in adolescence.
Slack's acceptance by companies happened organically, says Ray Wong, analyst at Constellation Research, which may be why it's fared better than other instant messaging apps.
What happened was people were just downloading the software. They found it the easiest way to work across geographies, across standards. And pretty soon, like, the whole company had Slack accounts, and they started to realize, oh my God, this is an enterprise piece of software.
A report by Mio, which helps companies integrate messaging platforms, says 73% of businesses with over 10,000 employees are now using Slack. Some of you told us that Slack also comes with downsides. Mainly, it can make it hard to unplug when the notifications are rolling in all at once. Emily Collier, who's a marketing consultant, says it was even tough to ignore when she was on maternity leave.
For me, I think it's the fact that it's an app on my phone that feels a lot like checking social media. So when I'm up at 2:30 in the morning nursing, I'm checking Twitter, I'm checking Instagram, and Slack is right there.
Slack gives users the ability to add or join channels, group chats, which can be about anything, not just work. Christine Movius is a software engineer in DC. She enjoys the social aspect.
It's sometimes funny. I'll be in the elevator and I'll see someone who looks familiar from Slack, but I've never actually met them in person. And then I'll look at them and say, I think I've talked to you in the gardening channel before. And then I'll introduce myself in person.
More than 10 million people use Slack every day. That doesn't come anywhere near Facebook's 1.5 billion. But Slack is the one that it's okay to have open at your desk all day. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
We would love your thoughts about how useful Slack is in your job, or, to be fair, not useful, I guess. We've got a Twitter poll running. We are at Marketplace on that social media platform. There is no shortage of facts and figures on this program. Interest rates, gross domestic product, home sales, how much Netflix costs, take your pick. We are going to do another number now, one that influences a huge piece of this economy and occupies a special place, not always a happy place, but a special one in the hearts and minds of a whole lot of people, 65, denominated in years old. Eric Barris looks at just how it got to be so meaningful.
Personally, I'm still a couple decades from 65, but I'm already expecting to have a love-hate relationship with it. Just listen to these folks. I met them at the Allegheny Elks Lodge in Pittsburgh, and they've seen their 65th birthdays come and go.
Some days I don't like it as much as other days.
That's when I said I became an official geezer.
That was Linda Nair and Joe Campisi. Then there's Joanne Asinger.
I actually couldn't wait till I turned 65 so I could collect Social Security.
Like I said, it's a love-hate thing. But how did 65 become a thing? The origin story dates back to 1935, when President Franklin Roosevelt set this in motion.
This Social Security measure gives at least some protection to 30 million of our citizens who will reap direct benefits through unemployment compensation, through old age pensions.
And ultimately, it was decided those old age pensions would kick in at 65, even though
there was nothing at all magical about age 65.
That's Edward Berkowitz, a retired history and public policy professor. Maybe not magical, but definitely practical. The country was in the throes of the Great Depression. Adult children who had traditionally taken care of their parents in old age no longer could. Roosevelt believed Social Security would solve that problem and also put an expiration date on work, making it easier for younger people to join the labor force. But first, this question had to be answered.
What is old age? When does it start? They knew that it doesn't start the same for everyone, but they had to come up with a plausible proposal.
60 was too young. Too many people would qualify, and that could bankrupt the system. 70, too old. People might not live that long. So they split the difference and settled on 65. Dora Costa is an economic historian at UCLA. She says the law,
it really did say, okay, this is when you basically become old. It's age 65.
The idea that everyone should retire at a certain age started showing up in popular culture, like this 1930s radio drama, Mama Bloom's Brood.
Maybe I'm getting too old to work anymore. Maybe Sidney and Harold was right. They got young ideas, I got old ones.
The federal government created public service announcements aimed at reassuring people that it was safe to call it a day.
And if you're nearing 65, or if you've already passed that age, you may need as little as a year and a half of work performed at any time since 1936 to become insured for life.
65 took on a life of its own. The gold watch became a thing. People started planning for life after work. Annuities and other investments were designed around that now magic number. By the time President Lyndon Johnson signed Medicare into law in the 1960s, there was no question when it would begin.
There are more than 18 million Americans over the age of 65. Most of them have low income.
That first year, Medicare cost the government less than $2 billion. Now, with nearly 50 million Americans on the rolls, the tab is more than $700 billion. Social Security expenditures are beyond a trillion. Historian and gerontologist Andy Achenbaum says spending like that isn't what lawmakers expected.
Now we have it where people tell me I'm going to live to be 90. I think it was sort of inconceivable to many people, except really far-sighted people, and we haven't really adjusted to that.
Because most of us couldn't really imagine that future either. When Paul McCartney recorded the song, He was in his 20s, but already starting to feel his age. He'd written the song as a teenager, a lifetime ago, so he had his producer speed the tape up so his voice would sound thinner, higher, and younger.
Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
As of yesterday, McCartney is 77, and he's still on tour. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
You can hear Paul McCartney's original tracks for that song alongside the tweaked ones at our website, marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, a quick Libra follow. Libra, of course, being Facebook's new cryptocurrency and payment system, it announced yesterday. Mark Zuckerberg's path to global nomination is eventually going to have to go through the U.S. Congress, and so far, indications are mixed. House Financial Services Committee Chair Maxine Waters said yesterday she wants the company to hold its horses on all this stuff until Congress and regulators have had a chance to weigh in. Today, the Senate Banking Committee said it is going to have a hearing next month. Investors mostly shrugged. Facebook shares down about 0.5% today. Hey, Marketplace listeners, it's Kai. We've got a new podcast out I think you're going to want to subscribe to. It's called This Is Uncomfortable. It's a weekly show about life and how money messes with it. It's hosted by Rima Kreis. She tells funny and honest stories about how money affects relationships and shapes identities and often defines what it means to be an adult. Please subscribe to our new show. It's called This Is Uncomfortable, and you can do that wherever you get your podcasts. All right, we're going. Dow Industrials finished the session up about 0.1% today, 38 points. The S&P 500 up almost 0.3%, 8 points. NASDAQ up 0.4%. That is 33 points. Thank you, Jay Powell. Our media production team includes Sarah Beguer, Jake Gorski, Drew Josdad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Talladay. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.